Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. COVID-19 cases are rising quickly again in Delaware, and experts warn it could get worse during the upcoming holiday season.
Not to, you know, kind of be a party pooper, if you will, on people's holiday traditions, but we've seen a lot of cases where people let their guard down with their family. They just have to remember that we're in a pandemic.
We talk with a DSU expert on global health about the state of COVID-19 in the first state and how people should respond to mounting cases. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about the role horseshoe crabs play in creating vaccines, even as their population shrinks. Arts Playlist previews the Brandywine River Museum of Art's holiday show. And Enlighten Me looks at research into the impact disasters have on mental health. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. COVID-19 cases are surging nationwide, and in Delaware, the pandemic has returned to a level not seen since the spring and early summer. Hospitalizations in the first state are at their highest since June, and the rolling average of new cases per day is up around 80% over 2 weeks ago. A recent study by state public health officials and the CDC concluded that Delaware's early efforts to control the pandemic were effective at bending the curve. And Governor John Carney said this week the state is considering bringing back restrictions on things like public and private gatherings as the holiday season approaches to keep cases down. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Delaware State University Professor Donna Patterson, an expert on global health and epidemics, about where the first state is right now in its fight against the virus.
A recent CDC study found that Delaware's stay-at-home order, mask mandate, and contact tracing were effective at somewhat curtailing the outbreak in Delaware. You've also written in support of Delaware's early response, particularly the testing and the regional coordination. What about those efforts made them effective?
There were a number of reasons that these measures were effective. John Carney, who is the governor of Delaware, for instance, was very proactive in moving very quickly in responding to the pandemic. Responding in terms of mask mandate and responding in terms of, you know, thinking about which businesses were essential and which businesses were not essential, but also in the businesses that were open, what were the guidelines? You know, so his first decisions were not as, you know, the most strict. They become very strict at one point, particularly, you know, kind of going into March and April and May. And then you see them loosening as we're getting, particularly around Memorial Day. They loosen a lot in terms of traffic, which also allows traffic, you know, to the beaches and that sort of thing. But there was this balance, if you will, between the public health response and the economic response. And I also knew, as someone, you know, who writes about history of medicine, public health, teaches global health, that I clearly get the public health piece. And I think it's very important, you know, to keep these numbers as controllable as we can, both in the state of Delaware, but throughout the country. But at the same time, the economic piece is very important. You can't have the whole economy collapse. And I definitely get that. And so there was this balance, because when he, you know, was even making some of these moves to reopen the beaches, you know, our numbers, you know, were not as flat as they could have been at that time. And so you have to really make sure that people are really adhering to what's happening, you know, so you won't have this explosion of cases in the state. And we did see the numbers go up in Delaware. You know, we've seen these different spurts through different periods since the pandemic came to our state in March. But, you know, comparatively, Delaware is fared better than most states. And definitely in terms of early response, our numbers were quite good. The testing was fantastic for what was available at the time. Of course, you know, there could have been more testing, but compared to most states in the country, we were ahead of the curve. And that was one of the ways that I think Delaware was really able to respond.
Daily new cases have risen again after they let up a bit this summer. Hospitalizations and the percent of people testing positive too. Where are we now in Delaware? Is this a second wave or a resurgence?
Yes, it appears that we're in a second wave throughout the country right now. Both the United States and much of Europe is now in its second wave. And that's been happening probably about a month or so. I'd say we've been moving into the second wave. Now, in terms of projections, the numbers are definitely going to go up in terms of the daily cases. And as I've mentioned briefly, we're already looking at over 100,000 daily cases in the United States every day. Projections are that those numbers are going to go up very quickly. And I wholeheartedly agree that they're going to go up to 200,000 probably in the next 3 to 4 weeks. As we get into December and January, we're going to see even more cases. And not only that, right now, the projections in terms of those dying by the end of January right now, and this is going on data that's even, I'd say, a few weeks old now. The projections are 400,000 Americans would have died by COVID by the end of January 2020, which is not that far away. We're looking at about 3 months or so from where we are now. It's extraordinary.
So what is your assessment of Delaware's current response to the virus? Is it as strong as it was this spring?
Delaware is still responding. I have seen Governor Carney, you know, make recent statements about the pandemic. And, you know, I know one of the things he's done is loosen the restrictions at the beaches. And some of that, I think, too, has to just do with the timing. You know, it's starting to get cooler. You're not going to have the same numbers at the beaches, for instance. And so you don't have to worry about issues such as social distancing as much. I have been somewhat concerned, I'd say, in the past 2 months, looking at the positivity rates in Delaware. They fluctuated quite broadly, but they've been averaging, in a lot of cases, over 5%, and in some cases, 8 to 10%. We're seeing a lot of variance, and the state is now reporting the testing, the positivity rates in a different way. But those positivity rates have been concerning at times. Are people getting tested in the same ways? Testing is widely available. Delaware is still doing great and making testing accessible to anyone who wants to test. You know, you can get tested at Walgreens, and there are these various pop-up sites and, you know, grocery store parking lots and other businesses, and also at schools and, you know, Camden, Delaware, Middletown, Delaware, and just, you know, all over the state beyond, you know, kind of these regular testing sites, if you will. And so it's very accessible to the community. And so I don't know if people are just not taking the initiative to get testing, or, you know, does the state need to think about how it's sending out reminders about testing, you know, kind of public service announcements? Where are these public service announcements going? Are they reaching the people that they need to reach?
As you mentioned, at the current rate, experts are predicting a deadly winter across the country. What can be done to prevent this?
Well, definitely widespread mask usage, proper mask usage, social distancing, and really thinking about congregating. Because what we've seen in recent weeks, particularly I'd say in the last 8-9 weeks, is that a lot of infections are actually being transmitted. They're being spread through small gatherings, family gatherings, maybe someone's birthday, maybe a wedding, these sorts of things. So it's happening more in these kind of familiar spaces. Because I think kind of early on, people thought of it as kind of, you know, it's outside and it's strangers. But we always knew that it wasn't just strangers, quote, strangers who could transmit the disease, but those close to you could potentially transmit the disease. And I think that's something to really think about. You know, think about, you know, if you're gonna have that Thanksgiving meal or that Christmas gathering, what is that going to look like? Should that gathering look the same way that it looked regularly? You know, should it be outside potentially versus inside? You know, if there's someone who's immunocompromised or elderly in your family, you know, should a lot of family from other parts of the state or the country necessarily maybe be congregating with them for long periods of time, and not to, you know, kind of be a party pooper, if you will, on people's holiday traditions. But we've seen a lot of cases where, you know, kind of, I think people let their guard down with their family. They just have to remember that we're in a pandemic, and it can be very inconvenient, but it is our reality at the moment.
Donna Patterson, Chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy at Delaware State University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to our Sophia Schmidt for that interview. Next on The Green, with good news this week on a possible COVID-19 vaccine, Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia examines the role horseshoe crabs traditionally play in vaccine development and how that may be changing as their population becomes more threatened. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Horseshoe crabs have been around since before the time of the dinosaurs, before the Delaware Bay, where they're often found, ever existed. And their blood is absolutely vital to keeping everything we inject into the human body safe from toxins, including vaccines. As scientists race to find a vaccine for COVID-19, Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia this week takes a look at horseshoe crabs' role in vaccine development and efforts to protect their declining population. That conversation starts with Glenn Guarvi, founder of the Ecological Research and Development Group, a Delaware organization focused on protecting horseshoe crabs.
Tell me a little bit more about horseshoe crabs then, since you guys are so focused and, you know, specialized in protecting the species. What are some of the benefits that horseshoe crabs bring to, I guess, the ecosystem first, and then I guess we can talk about human stuff later?
Well, I mean, I think one of the problems that we have and we've always had in terms of overcoming public indifference to the animal is that everybody does want to know, well, what's their value? What's their benefit? And one of the things that we've tried to do through our different programs is to overcome that way of looking at an animal or a human being, for that matter, in terms of I care or I protect you if you have some intrinsic value to me or to us. The broader umbrella in terms of our view towards horseshoe crabs is that they don't need to necessarily do anything to warrant our care, consideration, and protection. But since it does tend to be the hook that gets most people interested, certainly we're adept at answering those questions too. So the pharmaceutical industry, in terms of there's a test that's made from the blood of the horseshoe crab. It replaced a test that used to be made from rabbits. It's now globally used to test the purity of pharmaceutical products from endotoxins. Not all pharmaceutical products, though, are tested for endotoxins. If it's taken orally, like a pill that goes through your GI system, our body tends to be able to handle endotoxins in that format much better. But if it's injected into our bloodstream or into our lymphatic system or epidurals in terms of our spinal column, those areas, if there's any endotoxin present in that pharmaceutical product, can cause life-threatening problems, shock, fever, even death. So for a long time now, the FDA and the comparable organizations around the world require that all pharmaceutical products that come in contact with our blood, our mucous membranes, our spinal fluids, and our other systems, our lymphatic systems, be tested for the presence of endotoxins. And that test, like I said, used to be rabbits. We would inject a pharmaceutical product into the ear canal of a rabbit, and if it developed a fever or a shock, there was an unacceptable level of endotoxins. Now we use a simple test that's derived from the blood of the horseshoe crab to test the global pharmaceuticals. So I guess if one wants to look at their importance on a human level, what do we get from them, that would probably be the biggest. If you switch over to the natural world, we've got, a hemispheric phenomena happening every year in the Delaware Bay in terms of shorebirds migrating all the way up from the southern tip of Brazil, all the way going in their route to their Arctic breeding grounds. And Delaware Bay is a major stopover. And these animals, some of them have traveled 5,000 miles nonstop and are quite hungry. So the Delaware Bay is a feast of horseshoe crab eggs because it when they come through tends to coincide with when the horseshoe crabs are spawning, and a lot of the horseshoe crab eggs get churned up to the surface either through wave action or an abundant amount of spawning activity. One female might inadvertently dig up another female's nest. Nevertheless, there's a lot of eggs that will be deposited on the surface, and these birds can feed on those. So it's a very important link to the migrating shorebirds en route to their Arctic breeding ground every spring. If you drill down a little bit deeper in terms of just the Delaware Bay itself, these are benthic creatures. So they're constant movement around through the bottom of the bay, and their foraging and their spawning activity on the beaches themselves. They're kind of like little tractors. They're constantly churning up and turning over the substrate, whether it be the beach or whether it be the sediment in the waters that they inhabit off the, off our coastline. So that tends to create a more healthy environment in terms of the benthic community. So there's other things too, but those are kind of some of the main takeaways, I guess.
I mean, in terms of the medical side of things, I saw in the research study that you sent me that there is research into a alternative form of testing for endotoxins that does not use horseshoe crabs.
Yes, actually, it's beyond that. There's not research into it. It actually exists and is being used. The challenge right now will be the same, prior to the 70s, the test was rabbits, and that was the global test, and that was the test. That was the only test. And when horseshoe crabs became a viable alternative, it took time for the industry to start to accept this alternative. The LAL test made from the blood of the horseshoe crab. It's LAL in the United States because it's made from the limulus species. If it's being used in Asia, it's TAL because it's being made from the Tachyplea species. So when the LAL test, TAL test became available, there was that reluctance to move from a known commodity into an unknown commodity. And so there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of testing that needed to be done, a lot of validation that needed to be done in order for people to feel, for the pharmaceutical industry to feel comfortable migrating from one test to the other, and also for the FDA and comparable organizations around the world, the pharmacopeias, to feel comfortable suggesting that this test was as good as or equal to the test that everybody had currently been using. So we have right now a test called recombinant factor C, RFC for short, that is the alternative to horseshoe crab blood. It is approved for use by the FDA. It is approved for use by the pharmacopeias, both the U.S. pharmacopeia, the European pharmacopeia, the Japanese pharmacopeia, the Chinese pharmacopeia, and the European pharmacopeia. They've all approved this test for use in the detection of endotoxins used in the pharmaceutical industry. The problem or the challenge is that these pharmacopeias and the FDA still require the companies that use this new test, which they are allowed to use, validate its efficacy against the LAL test to ensure that how they're using it and what they're using it on yields the same level of results that they would have gotten if they had continued to use LAL. And there lies the what's slowing things down. That's the bottleneck, because to do that validation process is expensive. So a lot of companies are more comfortable just continuing to use LAL while the efficacy of RFC kind of makes its way through the different channels and eventually becomes considered equal to LAL, and no validation process would be required. So as long as there's a validation step involved, a lot of companies are reluctant to make the switch over to it, either because they would rather wait to see that this gets done and there's no challenge on it from a scientific level, or because it's too expensive and they would rather wait until they don't have to incur the additional expense. So as long as LAL is continued to be available to them, as long as the price of LAL is what they're used to paying. There's no big incentive to make the jump over to RFC. So, but there is an alternative out there, and it's being used. Eli Lilly is the largest company in the world right now that is using it. And they have made a pledge that this year, 2021 will be the year that they move 90% of all of their product testing over to RFC. That's huge. And that should help other companies feel more comfortable moving in that direction. One of the things that's interesting is Pfizer, which just came out with the vaccine announcement yesterday, is also moving over to RFC more slowly than Eli Lilly. I don't know the percentage of their operations that will be using it in the coming year, but they are in the process now of testing with it. How aggressively they migrate over to it, I don't know. And it's being used by other companies as well, both here and abroad. So there is an alternative to horseshoe crabs, and it is being used.
So basically the same thing that was happening when people were hesitant to switch from rabbits to LAL is happening now when people switching from LAL to RFC.
Exactly. Exactly.
Gavri says there have been noticeable population declines in the New York region due to over-harvesting for bait, but everywhere else in the Atlantic, horseshoe crab populations are stable or increasing. The bigger concern for the creature is in Asia, where there are three other species of horseshoe crabs. In the Atlantic, the crab is only partially drained and thrown back, so over 85% of crabs survive. In Asia, crabs are completely drained of blood, which is leading to over-harvesting. Zach Garmo is a science technician with the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays. He tells us what's happening locally to protect horseshoe crabs from the encroaching reach of land developments around the inland bays. What are the biggest risks to sort of horseshoe crab populations, especially in, you know, the inland bay? I've heard a lot. Part of the reason I'm doing this story is because I recently went to an event where Carper was visiting one of the new living shorelines at Dewey Beach. And I was thinking about how, like, oh, the living shorelines might actually be a good thing for horseshoe crabs because it's going to, you know, reduce wave erosion, reduce, like, wave intensity so they won't flip over as much and just die and get stranded and other things like that. What are some of the risks to horseshoe crab populations in the inland bays?
Yeah, I think that's a really good place to start with it because obviously you have sort of all the things that we've discussed so far. You know, if you're an individual horseshoe crab and you are trying to successfully come to the inland bays and reproduce, you know, of course, predation from all sorts of potential predators is a problem. Of course, you know, things like potentially like mortality from harvesting, you know, that is, you know, while LAL harvesting does do its best to limit mortality, it does occur. But I would say looking more at things like habitat, it's going to be a potential concern, right, is looking at losses of our sandy beaches. And so I think it's where the importance of what you're saying about living shorelines is worth noting. That, you know, it depends on the living shoreline as to whether or not that would be ideal habitat for a spawning horseshoe crab. But a living shoreline is going to be far better habitat for a horseshoe crab than, say, a riprap or any form of hardened shoreline. And because these sandy beaches are the only place that they can reproduce, you know, there's only so much of that that's around in the inland bays. And so being able to recreate that with our living shorelines is a really important piece of this puzzle here, is it allows us to give them more space to reproduce. And again, that depends on the living shoreline. Some living shorelines are going to be, you know, heavy, like have more heavy grass areas and not necessarily be open sandy regions. But that doesn't go for all of them. You know, the idea here is that at the end of the day, if we are taking hardened shoreline or eroding shoreline and returning it to a true living shoreline, all of the organisms that use the bays win from that. And that absolutely includes the horseshoe crabs.
Mm-hmm. One thing I saw was that the best way to preserve horseshoe crab populations and to keep them thriving is to leave them be and take humans out of the equation because they've lasted for 470 million years. So certainly without humans, they could last longer than that. And a lot of the reason why some populations like in New York are declining are because humans are getting in the way. There's over-harvesting. There's more hard shorelines, so less places for them to lay eggs. So, I mean, do you think that's the best way to go forward in terms of conservation? And, I mean, other than living shorelines, what else is kind of being done to, you know, keep this species from, you know, getting in trouble?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you have to strike a balance with these things. But I think you've absolutely touched perfectly on the incredible resilience of this species. You know, how many different ways, you know, like the idea that, like, they've been around since before the Inland Bays, that they have survived extinctions since, you know, that took out the dinosaurs and countless other organisms. And so they have that ability, and all we have to do is give them a chance, you know, making sure that they have the right, you know, the right habitat, making sure that they have space to reproduce and that we aren't over harvesting them. And again, that's part of what we're trying to do here, is making sure that we have good data on the horseshoe crabs in order to allow the people who make the decisions about harvesting to do so accurately. You know, we can't know what a sustainable harvest looks like without knowing how many we have. And while the people who make those decisions do have very good data, adding in the Inland Bays data is something that we think is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. If I am, you know, a regular citizen, what can I do to help the Center for the Inland Bays and just the Inland Bays in general with, you know, horseshoe crab populations and conservation?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. We're always looking for help with a variety of different projects, but in particular with the horseshoe crabs. And I'd say if you are interested in the horseshoe crabs, there's two main things you can do. The first is you can volunteer with us. We run an annual horseshoe crab survey, like I mentioned, on nights in May and June. And all of our surveys are run by volunteers. And so we're always looking for help to come out and count and tag horseshoe crabs. And we do so at six different sites throughout the Inland Bays. And you can go to our website if that is something you're interested in getting involved in. The other thing that you can do to help is if you do see a horseshoe crab and you see it, say, stranded on riprap or something to that effect, you can flip it over and put it back in the water. A lot of people think that horseshoe crabs can sting or can bite or can pinch, but that's actually not the case. You know, their tails are primarily used towards sensing their surroundings and for movement, and they can't sting you, and they can't pinch you either. They do have sharp points, so you need to be careful if you're picking them up, but these aren't blue crabs. They're not going to get you good if you pick one up. And so if you see one that's stranded on a rock or see one flipped upside down that can't flip back over, just flip it, you know, help it out and get it back in the water so it can be on its way.
Thanks to the Center for Inland Bays, Zach Garmo, Glenn Guarvey, founder of the Ecological Research and Development Group, and our Roman Battaglia for their time on The Green this week. And The Green continues in just a moment with Arts Playlist and a look at this year's holiday celebration at the Brandywine River Museum of Art. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The wonder of the holiday season is already underway at the Brandywine River Museum of Art in Chads Ford, PA. This year's holiday show there is titled Holiday Magic at Brandywine. It opened on October 31st and runs through January 10th, and it features the model train Brandywine Railroad, part of the museum's holiday celebration since 1972. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele is joined by Paul Horner, a model train specialist at the Brandywine River Museum of Art, to preview Holiday Magic at Brandywine.
Talk to us about the opening of the Brandywine Railroad. It's a holiday favorite since 1972. It's back on display at the Brandywine. What's happening?
Well, in case you didn't notice, it's been kind of an unusual year. So this year we were very fortunate in that we were able to extend the viewing time of the railroad. We opened on Halloween, October 31st, and I know it's one of my favorite holidays, and it was also one of the Wyeth family's favorite holidays. So we began running trains rained October 31st, and we took away some of our Christmas and holiday-themed decorations and put on some Halloween spooky trains and some fall foliage and leaves on the ground. And we'll have, we've had that up, and we will be changing over to our normal holiday decorations right around the week of Thanksgiving.
So talk to me about model trains. You're a model train specialist. I know nothing about trains. So talk to us about the Brandywine Railroad display.
Well, model trains have been a part of America since the early 1900s. A company named Lionel brought out standard gauge trains in the early 1900s. And boy, did it capture the imagination of Americans, because at that time, railroad travel was at its height. Christmas also became synonymous with trains, because at Christmas time in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, it was trains that brought the Christmas presents across the country from your Aunt Matilda out in Nebraska. When you had family coming in to visit you at the holidays, you'd go down to the train station and meet them there. So trains and the holidays became synonymous. And the museum, when it first opened in 1971, they started a holiday tradition to help bring people into the new museum. And the first holiday exhibit had some winter paintings from American artists N.C. Wyeth and Andrew Wyeth, and also some small little figures of the wind in the willows. And that sort of grew into our tradition of critters that you can see on our holiday trees here. And the second year it went so well, they decided, well, what else can we add? And the obvious addition was trains. So trains have been a part of holiday traditions here at the Brandywine since 1972. And my partner, Dave, and myself, he's been here since 1979, and I've been here since 1987, setting up the holiday exhibit every year so that generations of Brandywine Valley residents can come here and enjoy watching the trains running around our little miniature village and scenery. And it's just been a wonderful chance to be part of a tradition for so many families here in the Delaware Valley.
What makes model trains still popular after all these years? Why can't we get enough?
You know, there's something fascinating when you're a child with all the movement and the color and the lights, and seeing something so small reproduce what you see in real life and all the action. And I got to say, thank you to Thomas the Tank Engine for just hooking another several generations on trains. he does visit us from time to time here on our layout, so hopefully fans of Thomas will come by and say hi to him.
So what will the Christmas display look like? I mean, will there be drive-in movie theaters, carnivals, Christmas trees, a visit by Santa?
Well, for those of those guests that have been here year after year, you will see many of your favorites. However, because of the pandemic, we were forced to sort of rethink how we do our exhibit. If you've been here in the past, you know that we on the weekends get people shoulder to shoulder jammed in that gallery, and the layout, the way it exists, had a couple different bottlenecks, which made it very difficult to conceive of socially distanced and safe viewing. So we did a lot of rethinking, and we broke up the very large layout into two sections and have two little separate standalones of that layout. And we also brought in Nikki Wyeth's standard gauge train layout, which is 8 foot by 12 foot, and for the first time, an N-scale layout that was jointly owned by Jamie Wyeth and Andy Warhol, and it's 4 foot by 6 foot. So in the room, we have four standalone layouts that are all running trains. We've counted up. We run now 14 trains at once throughout the day. So even though it's not the large layout you're used to seeing, there is still plenty to see in the train exhibit. And yes, the movie theater is still there, people's favorite, and our one of our popular features of the past couple years were interactive buttons that you could push to interact with the layout. Well, this year, to make them hands-free, we switched over to foot pedals, so you can still interact with the layout, but in a safe, hands-free way.
Oh, that's a great idea. I'm in this era of COVID, when we can't touch and we have to social distance and everything else. What a great idea to bring in the foot pedals, right?
It has become very popular already with those that have been visiting us. And throughout the rest of the museum, there's still plenty to see. Up on the third floor, we have artist and composer Ann Wyeth McCoy's dollhouse on display. We brought that back this year. It was a very popular display several years ago, and it features six different rooms filled with three dozen dolls and hundreds of miniature objects. And then after Thanksgiving, the critters, critter trees will be going back up and be on view, and the annual critter sale will still take place on December 2nd through 6th with socially distanced shopping and face mask requirements to make it safe for everyone.
How is all this going to work as far as bringing people through? Do you have to wear a mask? Do you have to buy a time ticket, visit, you know, in a timed manner in order to space people out, Paul?
Yes. To ensure the safety and security and quality of the visitor experience, the Brandywine has implemented a variety of new COVID-19 procedures, including face mask requirements and timed ticketing, also capacity limits. So all guests will need to reserve time tickets. If you've dealt with Longwood and their Christmas light display, you're familiar with the idea of timed tickets prior to visiting us. Tickets will be available on sale here, but if we've already reached our capacity for that half hour to an hour, then you will have to come back later on in the day. So we do encourage everyone to do advanced reservations online at www.brandywine.org.
All right, just want to remind everybody, we're talking to Paul Horner. Paul is a model train specialist who works for the Brandywine River Museum of Art in Chads Ford, PA. We're talking about the Holiday Magic at the Brandywine. It's a brand new exhibit already open, and Paul specifically addressing the Brandywine Railroad, a holiday favorite since 1972 at the Brandywine. Paul, what is some fun facts as a model train specialist? What are some fun facts you could share with us about model trains, something we might not otherwise know?
Well, model trains date back to the early 1900s, and even though back then they were slightly cruder models, a lot of them made out of pressed tin with lithograph printing on them, and tended to be quite noisy, rattling and banging around your living room and possibly dribbling some oil on your nice new carpet. But it captured the imagination of Americans that wanted to recreate what they saw in real world at home. During World War II, Lionel Corporation switched over from making trains to making electrical motors for the military, and through that they were able to make the motors smaller. And so the standard gauge, your locomotive is a good foot long and 6 inches wide. And boy, you know, you need a good 12 foot by 8 foot space just to have a very simple layout. But as the motors got smaller, you could do more and more in a smaller space. And so O gauge, which is probably people's most familiar with, is a three rail O gauge train. And trains are O gauge. And then throughout the years, it went on down to HO, which is half that size, down to N, down to Z, where instead of a locomotive being about a foot long, a locomotive is about an inch and a half long. And now we even have micro trains, and a locomotive is about an inch long, and we have several different little micro train layouts running around our O-gauge layout so that our citizens on the O-gauge trains, they have model trains that they get to run to.
Well, I can't wait to see this exhibit. What got you interested in model trains?
Well, you know, like many people, my father got me into trains during the holiday season when I was a 2, 3, 4-year-old. On Christmas Eve, he would sneak into my room and put out a full Lionel O-gauge train layout on the floor. And when I woke up, magically, Santa had brought us trains. And I got to run it for about a week and had fun with that. And then one night when I'd go to sleep, the elves would come back and take them all back to the North Pole until next year. And so that began my lifelong love of trains. And when I was a freshman in college at Westchester University, I answered a help wanted ad, wanted people to come help set up the Brandywine River Museum of Art's annual Christmas display. So the week before Thanksgiving, I came down, and that was 1987. I've been doing that every year since.
Well, I mean, how many people, you know, you grew up loving trains and now you're a model train specialist? Who would have thunk it, right?
It is. I'm very fortunate. It is a lot of long hours and a lot of stress because we pride ourselves in having a very professional layout. And we think of it as a show for our guests. When they walk into that gallery, we want them to forget about everything that's going on out in the world and just get lost in our world. And if trains are constantly derailing or stopping or falling off the tracks, then, you know, it's not a very good show. So we really put a lot of pressure on ourselves to make sure the trains run as smooth as possible. But besides that, it's just a wonderful chance to be part of great memories. That's become kind of our tagline, is all aboard for a lifetime of memories.
Thanks to the Brandywine River Museum of Art's Paul Horner and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and more on a UD professor's study on the impact disasters have on mental health. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A researcher at the University of Delaware was among those involved in a recent study to find a link between natural disasters and mental health issues. And in this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino sat down with Jennifer Horney, a professor in UD's Department of Health Sciences Epidemiology program, to discuss what that study found.
Okay, I guess for starters, what brought about the idea to start this research to try to link natural disasters to mental health issues?
So we've known for a long time that disasters can have both acute and long-term mental health impacts, but because of the way that policies are set up to provide funding for mental health assistance after disasters, we usually don't have any good data that goes out more than 1 year post-disaster. So one thing we're interested in is finding out more about these long-term impacts.
And how did you go about doing that?
So we looked at data from counties that had a single disaster over a 12-year period. And so that gave us a period of time both before and after the disaster, so we could look 3 years post-disaster. And we're used to seeing, based on the research literature before, that there would be increases in things like anxiety, depression, and PTSD. But less is known about the sequelae of some of those, which in this particular instance, we looked at suicide after disasters.
And what did you find?
So what we found was that the rate of suicide increases in counties that have been exposed to disasters, both in general, all types of disasters, and then certain types of disasters. And we found something that was supportive of this idea that we needed to change policy on the funding guidelines and the timeliness of providing support for mental health, because we found that in the second year after disaster was typically when we saw the highest increases in the rate of suicide.
And with the increases that you did see, do you think it's enough to make the case for saying that natural disasters have a causal relationship to suicides, and that after a disaster happens, it leads to more people committing suicide?
So I think there are a couple of cautions to saying that it's causal. The association is complex, and so there are a lot of factors that we didn't measure, including prior mental health diagnoses, as well as other types of things. So in case studies, we've looked at the differences, for example, between people whose homes have been damaged and people whose homes have not been damaged. So it seems like you're more at risk for a mental health outcome after disaster the more personal damage that you've suffered, or more personal harm, damage to your home, and that sort of thing. So it's not yet, we're not yet able to say causal, but we're certainly able to, again, put some increases in rates and of suicide in those disaster-affected counties compared to counties that weren't affected by disasters.
You're quoted in the UD article as calling these preventable deaths and saying that there needs to be an improvement in disaster preparedness and response. What would that look like?
Well, I think we're mostly all in agreement that disasters are increasing in frequency and severity. And so we need to update our preparedness plans so that we know that they address people who are vulnerable, not just to physical impacts, like, you know, maybe being caught in a flood or a damaged home, but also to consider the mental health impacts that may be there. So if we have better preparedness planning, then we have a better idea of the scope and scale of mental health services that we need to provide after a disaster. And then we also now have a better understanding that funding that comes from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to help state and local governments respond to disaster, mental health should not expire after 1 year. That funding should be available for groups to continue to provide counseling and other services to people impacted for 2 or 3 years after a disaster.
Is this something that you feel Delaware should have to worry about, given the storms that we had over the summer?
Absolutely. And I think that right now is a particular concern because we have these cascading or complex disasters of a pandemic that's overlaid with flooding or the impact from windstorms and hurricanes. And so we definitely know from the disaster research literature that the impact of multiple disasters at the same time or sequentially is increased. And so I think it's really important that we think about what these natural disaster impacts mean in light of the fact that we've all been dealing with a pandemic for the last 9 months.
Thanks to University of Delaware Professor Jennifer Horney and our Nick Schellino for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Roman Battalion, Nick Schellino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.